Hi, everyone. Welcome to Living Blind, a podcast by Balance for Blind Adults. I'm your host, Naomi Hazlett, occupational therapist. And today I'm going to be speaking with guests Lucas Harris and Michelle McQuigg. They came on the show to discuss a recent concert by the Toronto Chamber Choir titled Musical Vision, A Brief History of Music and Blindness. Lucas Harris is the conductor of the Toronto Chamber Choir, and Michelle McQuigg was the narrator for the show. Lucas and Michelle took me through a musical journey that really paid homage to blind and low vision composers and performers. I was really taken aback just about the absolute depth of history that there is, even with a sneak connection or a surprise connection to Louis Braille. It was really wonderful to hear them speak about how all the pieces of the collaboration came together and the passion that they had in making this performance happen. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did, and learn a thing or two along the way about music and blindness. So first, I would like to know, where did this all start? How did the concept for this collaboration, this concert begin, and how did everybody get connected?
This is all Lucas, so I'll let him tell the story.
Well, I just, you know, was having to think through, you know, once a year I have to sit down and kind of plan a season for the Toronto Chamber Choir, which usually involves four concerts. And I just kind of had a light bulb about exploring blind composers and blind musicians, and just did a quick bit of Googling and was absolutely astounded to see, you know, I thought we might find, you know, a couple of examples here and there of, you know, notable blind composers, but everywhere I looked, in the medieval period, in the Renaissance, in the Baroque, in the classical period, Romantic period, contemporary music, in folk music, in jazz, traditional music, everywhere I was finding references to brilliant blind musicians. And I just got incredibly excited about it. And I, the first thing I did was I phoned up my friend Joan Robinson, who's a friend of mine who happens to be blind, and we have a pretty intimate connection because my family adopted her guide dog when she retired. And I don't want to go into too much personal detail, but her guide dog Tallulah was really changed her life, in that Joan is a huge music lover, and she has been to music festivals all around the world, and you know, she's at like probably every other concert I play here in Toronto. She just loves music. And when she got Tallulah, suddenly she was able to travel more. So she went with Tallulah to music festivals in Germany, in England, in Italy, in Vienna. Tallulah wore a jeweled collar to like the Vienna State Opera. And she was even kind of like an ambassador for guide dogs. She went to one particular festival in Germany, and they weren't going to let her in. And Joan said, "Oh no, thank you very much. I will be admitted with my guide dog." And she showed them, and they went to their seat, and Tallulah just, in spite of her size, she kind of curled up into a teeny little ball underneath her chair, and didn't make a sound for the entire concert. And so then the next year they welcomed her. They're like, "Oh, Tallulah's here." And they even called her the Mozart Hund, the Mozart dog. So anyway, the first thing I did was phone up my dear friend Joan and told her about this idea, and she thought it was a great idea. And she said, "You should phone up Deborah Gold from Balance for Blind Adults," which I did, and sort of floated the idea. And the partnership there just kind of evolved very easily. And then the way I found Michelle was, there's actually a woman in the Toronto Chamber Choir, Mary Cowan, who's a U of T history professor. And I happened to mention, you know, this programming idea I was starting to develop. And she said, "You know, if you like, I can put you in touch with this friend of mine who I used to sing with in the Toronto Children's Chorus many, many years ago, Michelle McQuigg." And we, you know, I kind of looked at Michelle a little bit online, and Mary arranged for us to have Zoom, and I just, you know, floated the idea. And as we were talking, you know, I said, at some point, you know, I'd like to find a narrator for this program, and I think it should be somebody from the blind community. And I said, you know, maybe it could be you. And Michelle said, she thought about it for a minute and said, yeah, I think I'd really like to do that. And I just had a sense right away that she was absolutely the right person. You know, being a journalist, Michelle is so brilliant and articulate, and she also understands music. You know, being not only a choral singer, but I think Michelle's also a pianist. And anyway, she just fit, she just checked all the boxes, and I just loved collaborating with her the whole time.
Kind of helps me understand that the concert kind of comes from this bigger web. I mean, I'm hearing that you came up with this idea or was somehow inspired yourself, Lucas, but then immediately went out there and talked to people who might be able to give you a little more feedback on developing the concept. And I think it's a good reminder that a lot of our ideas, maybe they start from somewhere, but then they're much better. They tend to grow the more people that are involved. And it was very interesting for me to track that development and how those connections came together along the way. So now that we know a little bit about how the background behind the concert, how it all started, we know that you did a little bit of preparation and research before putting on the concert. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more. You know, you were doing some research online, and the more you researched, the more you found blind and low vision composers and artists. Can you tell us a little bit more about that process, the research, the selection of artists? Go into a little more detail about that part of the process.
I knew already a little bit about some of the blind composers. You know, as a former classical guitarist, I certainly knew about Joachim Rodrigo, who's, you know, one of our big classical guitar heroes. And I did know about Bach and Handel, both of them going blind at the end of their lives, and both of them having been operated on by the same charlatan eye surgeon. So there were some things that I knew already. And beyond that, honestly, I really did most of my research just kind of sitting at the computer and Googling around. And I found a page that kind of listed a number of blind composers. And then I would, you know, research each name to see, I was looking especially to see if any of those composers had written choral music. And interestingly, I found some of them did. Certainly Bach and Handel wrote lots and lots of choral music. Some of the other composers I found were instrumentalists, and so I found a lot of references to like solo instrumental music and sometimes smaller genres like songs. And I decided that I would have a harpist in this concert because I was finding a lot of information about blind harpists. And so that was, we had one set by O'Carolan, the famous Irish harper, and one set by John Perry, who was a Welsh triple harper in the time of Handel, and, you know, used to perform the Handel Harp Concerto and so forth. And, you know, the rest is really just kind of like a weird kind of algorithm, you know, like I just, I wanted to tell a story kind of across several centuries. So I was kind of looking to do kind of one or two pieces from each era. So we started in the Renaissance with Antonio de Cabezón, who was a celebrated blind keyboard composer. I also found some information about composers for my instrument, for the lute. And we did a song by this German composer from the Renaissance called Arnold Schlick. And then we moved into the Baroque and did the set about Bach and Handel and this Welsh harper, John Perry. And I mentioned O'Carolan already. And then I wanted to sort of take it, you know, into the modern era. So I found a song by this Viennese lady called Maria Theresia von Paradis, beautiful little song about how the piano is kind of her comfort and solace. It almost seems like autobiographical. And I also found some information about a Brazilian mixed race composer called Joaquim Manuel da Câmara, whose music was transcribed by a Viennese composer who happened to be living in Rio de Janeiro for a few years and wrote down some of his music and took it back to Europe and prepared for it to be published. And so those little transcriptions for voice and keyboard are the only scrap of musical legacy we have of this blind guitarist who apparently was an incredible performer, but just performed on the streets of Rio. And then we got into the Romantic era with this British composer, George Alexander Macfarren, did a lovely Shakespeare setting of his. Then we got into the whole school of, this is one of my favorite parts of the program,
Me
was
too. The
about
French organist.
the French organists.
Yes.
Yeah, so in, we did a beautiful Tantum Ergo by Louis Vierne. And I started to really dig on this one, and I found out the reason why there are so many blind French organists starting in the kind of first part of the 19th century, going all the way well into the 20th century. I don't know if we even have time to talk about that. If we do, I'll let Michelle maybe tell some of that story. And then we did Rodrigo, not a guitar piece, but a choral piece that he wrote when he was a young man. And then we finished with a new commission by this pianist, Michael Arnowitt, who set a text by James Joyce. He really wanted to set some words by a blind poet. And so he chose some words from Finnegan's Wake and created a new choral piece for us. And I don't even know if he'd ever written choral music before, but it was quite an interesting piece and quite a good challenge for the choir to work on. So I managed to find, sort of composers all along, sort of from the Renaissance all the way up into the modern day, basically. So I was trying to kind of show that, blind musicians and blind composers have really been there throughout that whole period and beyond as well.
Coming back to the research part, and I know it may not always sound like the most exciting part. Maybe listeners want to hear more about what the concert was like, but we'll get there in due time. I do really think it's important to dig into this a little bit more because, when we talk about research, a lot of the time we think we sit down and open up Google and away we go. And I know, Lucas, you mentioned Wikipedia, which is another awesome resource. Was there anything that required a little more digging, or maybe talking to Mary or your other contacts in terms of putting it all together?
One thing I would just mention is that I found out by chance about a blind organist who lives in London, Ontario, called John Vandertouwen. And I phoned up John. I kind of got his phone number from through some another organist friend. And I phoned him up and I wanted to just explore if like maybe he could kind of make an appearance at this concert, maybe play one organ solo. And it didn't end up working out, but I was really interested to find out that he traveled to Paris and basically made his organ solo recital debut in Paris as a teenager. And he studied with this person called Jean Langlais, who was basically, I think one of the last directors of the School for Blind Children in Paris that we spoke about in the concert. And so that was really exciting. I felt like I was actually like in touch with a person in Southern Ontario who was connected to this tradition of blind French organists that went all the way back to the first part of the 19th century.
I think this is a good place to maybe segue in terms of that combination of researching out there on the internet, but also talking to people and making those connections out in the field. I want to turn to Michelle now, and I want to ask you more about your role. I know that you were narrating the concert at the time, but can we take a step back and tell us, when did you get started in terms of preparing the concert, whether it was selection of pieces, the script? How did it start with you?
Sure. Well, Lucas approached me about the opportunity to be the narrator, actually a little bit more than a year ahead of time, because the concert schedules are well planned in advance. And I actually did not have a whole lot to do. I didn't really re-enter the picture until closer, I'd say a month or 6 weeks before the concert itself. I really cannot stress enough how much this was Lucas's brainchild and how much he did 100% of the research, and I would say a good 97 or 98% of the writing. So the way it worked when I did kind of re-enter the mix on this concert was Lucas had roughed out a script. He'd made certainly all the artistic selections had been done and the performers lined up and whatnot. But he came to me with this draft script and said, can you take a look at this and let me know what you think? And it was fantastic. Where I came in was in the editing and finessing process, because sometimes words that are written out on paper don't necessarily make for smooth reading aloud. And that was my big focus, was to make sure that I could narrate things in a fairly smooth and fluid way, and where I didn't have to sound too stiff, and I wanted to be able to maintain a quasi conversational tone in all of this. So that I went through and just sort of tightened things up a little bit. And if I had questions or if something was unclear, I would leave notes for Lucas on that front. So I would say we did three or four exchanges like that with the script, with us passing it back and forth in a cloud document. And then we got to the point where we were quite happy with it all. And I was tasked with writing a conclusion. So I wrote that. And once Lucas had signed off on everything, we got together one last time in person rather than exchanging a document, and kind of read through it all together. And even in that process, we were deeply familiar with the material by then, but even on and with that last read through, we kept identifying things we could finesse or things we could trim altogether. There's never an end to the edits you can make when you get going on something, but we did ultimately reach a point where we were happy with it, and that was the final script that I used in the concert itself. And the role that I played there was to tell the stories and bring Lucas's research to life as best I could by explaining the histories of these blind composers, the contributions they made, some of the anecdotes that Lucas had uncovered, and kind of setting up the performances that would then follow to make the audience hear what their work sounded like.
It certainly sounds like a very iterative process with lots of drafts and revisions. I'm wondering, Michelle, while you were reviewing the material and going over Lucas's research, were you learning a thing or two along the way about musicians and composers?
I was learning so many things, and Lucas can vouch for this. The first email I sent him in response to the script was basically all exclamation marks, because it was really fun. I loved learning about all these things. I have a reasonable background with classical music through a long-standing time of playing and singing. So I'd heard of some of these composers, but certainly not all. So in some cases, the composers themselves were entirely new to me. In other cases, there were just connections established that I was not aware of. Lucas had mentioned earlier about the French organist school in France in the 19th century, and we can come back to that. But it was that kind of anecdote that was really fascinating, or hearing more about Turlough O'Carolan. He was the Irish harpist almost in, I don't know if it was quite medieval times, but medieval Renaissance, somewhere quite a while back. And he was an itinerant harper who would travel all over Ireland and was, you know, highly sought after by wealthy Irish residents and nobles. All these kinds of stories were crazy. But reading about the absolute atrocities that this one eye surgeon performed on both George Friedrich Handel and Johann Sebastian Bach, two absolute luminaries of the classical canon. Lucas found all the great details. So there was a ton to take in and a ton to learn, and I found it really fascinating. So it was really fun to engage with all that content.
I just wanted to mention too that it was really helpful that Michelle was, you know, kind of helping me see the material from the point of view of, you know, somebody from the blindness community or from the, you know, kind of disability community. One time that came up was when we were telling the story of Maria Teresa von Paradis, who was this blind pianist composer from the time of Mozart and Haydn. And there was, she as a young woman was brought to a doctor, a Viennese doctor called Franz Mesmer. And yes, the word mesmerizing in English actually comes from his name. And her parents basically brought her to this doctor desperate to find a cure for her blindness. And we had a really nice conversation about, you know, this attitude that so many people have that, you know, that people with blindness or another kind of disability, that some people believe that they have this kind of flaw that needs to be fixed. And the kind of language that Michelle introduced into the script to kind of acknowledge that was a very common perspective, and that it's a perspective that we really don't need to take, was very similar to the language I knew from the autism community. I have a 12-year-old daughter who's autistic, and there are many people in the autism community, including even in kind of autism organizations, who have been criticized for using that kind of language, you know, that like adult autistic people have come forward and said, you know, when you speak about autism as something that needs to be fixed, you're raising money to find a cure for it. It makes us feel like we're broken people and that we're not really like a full member of society. Yeah. And so Michelle just added a little line, you know, in the script to say that, you know, Maria von Paradis's parents were desperate to find a cure and brought her to this Dr. Mesmer. And, you know, this is, I'm just going to read here, a prevalent attitude of the time and one that persists today despite mounting pushback from the disability community. And I thought that was great. I mean, and I think there were a couple other places in the script where Michelle's perspective just helped to kind of bring things into kind of a more progressive lens, I guess.
And a lot of that was informed by my, not only my own lived experience, of course, but from my work. When now I'm currently an editor at my news outlet, but prior to that, I was a reporter and I would do a lot of disability reporting whenever I could. And it was coming across a lot of those attitudes within the disability community in iterations well beyond blindness. But just seeing those attitudes, I just felt it was important to introduce a bit of that nuance. And it was really great that Lucas was incredibly receptive. And we could always have really, really great conversations around these things whenever they came up.
So Lucas was, I guess, in a sense, bringing more of that past, that history. And then, not to say, of course, there was the brand new composition as well. But Michelle, you were bringing your experience being a member of the community and digging in from your role as an editor, a writer, to really bring everything together, the history and the contemporary, the current views of disability and the arts.
That's right. But really, my main role was to help bring the content to life just by we settled on the words together, but my job was to tell these stories about these composers and what they did, and have the music sort of wind up being helping to be the second parts of these stories. There are always sort of two parts: my verbal description of what was happening, then the performance. And every segment was treated like that, and it made it quite immersive, I think.
Well, that brings me to my next question, which is, what was the reception or feedback from people that came to the concert? And I'm sure you had reviews or feedback from people both sighted and blind. So can you tell me a little bit more about what that was like?
Where I was, it seemed to be really well received. I had a couple of friends who came, which was really nice, and they loved it. We've had interest expressed in repurposing the program in a couple of different places. So Lucas would be privy to a lot more feedback from me, but everything I heard was very positive.
Yeah, I think I mostly heard good things. And a few people from the blind community who came to the concert basically reacted almost the way Michelle reacted to the script draft, you know, which is to say, wow, I didn't know any of this, you know, or I knew very little of this. I really learned a lot. Yeah, it was really a very satisfying project for me to work on. And I really hope we can redo this concert actually at some point in the future.
Me too. It was a ton of fun.
Do you think you would do the concert as is, or is there anything that's kind of come up since the performance that you'd want to add or change?
I'll leave that to the artistic director.
I found so much material. I mean, I feel like I could, you know, produce, like I could probably create a kind of volume two, Musical Vision volume two, with a completely different program. But in a way, I feel like that this, you know, the selection of pieces and the, you know, the way the script came out, I think it's, I feel very satisfied with how it came out, and I'd love to just do it again, basically with no changes.
Absolutely. Why not?
Except for one, which is, I think it needs an intermission.
Oh, how long was it?
The one thing I was
longer than we thought it was going to be.
The one thing I was very embarrassed about was the running. I underestimated the running time of the concert by something like 20 minutes, even though I timed all the music and timed all the speeches and even like added a little bit of time for transitions. And somehow I basically realized at the end, like I had kept the audience there for almost 2 hours without a break, you know, and I thought, oh my gosh, people are probably just going to make a mad dash for the bathroom as soon as the concert was over. So I think, you know, that this concert was in this format that my choir does, which we call the Café Musique. And about 20 or 30 years ago, one of the directors of the choir came up with this format so that the choir could double the amount of performances that it does from 2 to 4 in a given season. And these Café Musiques were kind of meant to be these half programs, you know, where the choir would just prepare half of a program of music and the music director would talk half the time. And then it would be like an hour long, and people then would have baked, you know, cookies and things that the choir had made for the audience. And in my never ending quest to make more work for myself, I have turned the Café Musique into, you know, kind of a scripted performance that, you know, kind of attempts to sweep people back in history and explore a certain topic. And I find I can't do that in under about at least 80 or 90 minutes. And this was the longest one I've ever done. I mean, I think it, including the opening speech, it came out to almost 2 hours. So I think if we do this again, I think we just have to add an intermission. There's too much material. I don't think I could cut anything.
Hopefully, if you do it again, I don't know if you would ever consider recording it. I wish I could come to see it, but I'm all the way out in Montreal. So, but either way, I'm sure a repeat would be well received by concert goers. This might be a good time to talk about the story of the French organist, because both of you remarked on how it was a good one. It was an interesting one. So I'm gonna let you tell me all about these legendary French organists that you both sort of alluded to earlier on.
Sure. Lucas, please jump in if I'm omitting anything here. I don't have the script in front of me, so I won't read it verbatim, but if you need me to do that later, Naomi, I can always send you a recorded version of me doing that. At some point in France, a school got established that was essentially working to train blind students and send them out as organists. And at the time, this was all based in Paris. And at the time, Paris's cathedrals were, because of revolutionary activity that had been going on for quite some time, we're talking about the early 19th century here, this was all established. Because of all the political turmoil in France at the time, there was a real dearth of organists in Paris cathedrals. So as these students got trained up, they were being sent out to work right away in cathedrals. So at the peak, Lucas, if the number is right, something like 14 blind organists performing in cathedrals around the city. Is that right?
By 1833, there were 14 students from the Institut National des Jeunes Aveugles, the National Institute for the Young Blind. There were 14 of students there that were working in Parisian cathedrals, trying to fill these vacant positions after the French Revolution.
So there was already quite a strong basis, but a real big part of why this took root is because of a student who attended the school by the name of Louis Braille.
So this is where, there we go.
Right? So this is where everything kind of came together. I went, oh, what? When I read that particular detail. So he was himself a musician and an organist, and he was training at the school. And this is part of why he was devising the Braille code, was to have some kind of notation system, because scores were incredibly cumbersome and difficult to produce at that point. That was a major impetus for developing the system that we now use today, known as Braille. So it's a really direct and tangible connection that not only makes a lot of sense of that specific phenomenon in the 19th century, but has lasting impact now. So I found that really fascinating.
I feel like you're not going to be alone. I mean, that was a new fact for me. And I feel like a lot of the people listening to this show are also sitting here and thinking, That's a part of the story of Louis Braille that I've never heard before.
Yeah, I don't know how that got left out of his myth. The fact that he was an organist and a very accomplished musician in his own right. I seem to recall reading a biography of Louis Braille, so it's possible that it got mentioned, but it's certainly never lodged in my memory. And I don't think it's part of the collective perception of this man. And it should be, because it's a really integral part of his story.
And if I could just mention that there's a really interesting connected story, which is that the tradition of blind piano tuners and technicians actually started at the same time. There was this guy called Claude Montal, and he was also a student at the Institute I think it may have just been like that the piano like at the Institute was out of tune, and he wanted to tune it, and I think his professor said, oh, I'm not sure that's a good idea, and he basically kind of proved to them like that he had the mechanical skills necessary to get this piano in tune. And then they asked him to teach this to the other students there, and it developed into kind of a piano tuning school. And by 1860, he had basically established an intensive 3-year program of study, which had 250 students learning to be piano technicians. And he also opened his own piano factory. And the methods that he used for working on pianos and the kind of tradition of blind piano technicians spread throughout France and Britain, and they found their way into the United States and Canada, and actually continues to this day. Very often I've mentioned this to people, and they say, oh yeah, I know a blind piano tuner, he still works at the conservatory, or you know. So again, it's like that organist from London, you know, like there are these little ramifications that could persist to our time, that you know started in this period in France in the first part of the 19th century, which is just fascinating to me.
Lucas's brain, and therefore the script, is just chock a block with nuggets like this. Like around every turn, there was a new little anecdote just like that. And the piano tuner legacy is a really interesting one too, because again, it's an absolutely fascinating thing, and it did open up a viable career path at a time when there were not many. But over time too, it also became more associated as a bit of a negative stereotype within the blindness community, because that became some people's de facto response to any kind of job prospect. There's always so much nuance to all these things.
I know, and I wish we had the time to go into all of the pieces around blindness and employment, and much like the concert itself, our conversation has just been a network leading out into even more topics. Mm-hmm. But all that is to say is, if this hasn't gotten people interested in going to a repeat of the concert, I don't know what will, because all I can think about is, oh, I need more music facts. So thank you both so much for sharing them.
Well, and I have to say, it's more than just about the facts, though. The performances are beautiful. The Toronto Chamber Choir is a beautiful organization. They sound great. The guest performance were all terrific. There was an organist and the harpist that was brought in to play historical harp. So it was really, it was very much the combination of the two, and the music is as important as the words. And it was, Lucas did a great job with both.
Well, like I said, thank you both so much for coming on the show today. I feel like we've only scratched the surface of an incredibly deep topic, but hopefully this has given listeners an idea of what the concert was all about. Starting with Lucas, can you tell us where people can find you if they want to get in touch and learn more?
I have a website, which is this lucasharris.ca, and it needs to be updated, but you can find how to contact me there. And you can also always go to the choir's website, which is torontochamberchoir.ca.
Great, thank you. And Michelle?
If anyone wants to reach out to me, they're welcome to do so on your best bets are probably LinkedIn or Twitter. I'm on Twitter as Mish McHugh, so MICH_MCQ. And I can, my DMs are open, so anyone can reach out to me there. Another easy way to get a hold of me would be by email at work, which would be mmq@cp.org.
Wonderful. Okay. Once again, thanks so much, Lucas and Michelle, for coming on the show. I learned so much in a short period of time, and I look forward to hearing about what projects are coming down the pipes next for the Toronto Chamber Choir.
Thanks for having us, Naomi.
Thank you.
Well, that was a fantastic conversation, wasn't it? Hello, everyone. I'm Deborah Gold, CEO at Balance for Blind Adults and executive producer here at the Living Blind podcast. I wanted to tag on here because I found this particular discussion so interesting. I was present at the Toronto Chamber Choir Musical Vision Concert in May of last year, 2023, and I can verify that there really is nothing quite like having a concert like this narrated. The stories and Michelle's perspective on them were the reason that I decided to ask Michelle and Lucas to join us for an episode of the podcast so that we could talk more about how they conducted the research, how they decided to construct the script, because there's really nothing quite like the richness provided by that kind of storytelling to go with music, and particularly music that many of the audience may never have encountered before. Those stories help to transport the listeners to the time and place that the music was composed, and to envision so much better the composer and their perspective on their life, their music, and their experiences as people who are blind or living with visual disabilities. The performances themselves were also incredible, and we wish we could share those with you as well. In addition, I think it was really important for sighted audience members to see the concert narrator reading Braille to provide the narration. Balance for Blind Adults was proud to partner with the Toronto Chamber Choir on this event, and we look forward to other such partnerships within the Toronto performing arts community in the future. Interested in accessible arts programming, or making your current program or curriculum more accessible to those with visual disabilities? We're the experts. Call us at 416-236-1796 or email info@balancefba.org, and we would be more than happy to discuss a partnership or consultation to help you make your program or performance better because it's more accessible. Thanks for listening. We'll see you here next time on the Living Blind podcast.
And now a word from Balance for Blind Adults.
Hi, Deanna here, Development Officer at Balance for Blind Adults. We recently had a volunteer and donor celebrate their 25th wedding anniversary, and in lieu of gifts, asked their friends and family to consider a donation to Balance, their charity of choice. Whether it's a birthday, anniversary, or graduation, Balance loves to celebrate important milestones with our community. Visit www.balancefba.org to learn more and to make a donation. Thank you for your support and happy anniversary to the Brienne.
Bonus content from Balance for Blind Adults.
Yeah, this was another story that really jumped out at me when I was reading the script. So as I mentioned before, both Johann Sebastian Bach and George Friedrich Handel, who were contemporaries and legends of Baroque era composers, both were losing their sight later in life, and they both turned to a man by the name of John Taylor for help. He was a self-styled eye surgeon who traveled all around Europe and made a very significant name for himself in the era. He was happy to accept payment in the form of gold watches or whatever valuables people wanted to give, but he was pretty expensive. He was a bit of a marketing guru long this before this was a real thing. He drove around in a distinctive coach with a slogan and in incorrect Latin on the side that he thought said, what gives vision gives life. It sounds like he was a fairly colorful character for the time. But both Bach and Handel turned to him for a procedure that's called couching. And I'm going to read from the script here, if you don't mind, just to give a sense of what's going on here. Taylor performed a procedure called couching, in which a special curved needle is poked into the back of the eye, and then the cataract clouded lens is pushed out into the rear and out of the field of vision. This is done without anesthetic, while a patient is held in an upright position by one or two other people, often out in the open air with people looking on. The post-operative procedure involved nice modern techniques, bloodletting, laxatives, and eye drops from slaughtered pigeons, pulverized sugar, and baked salt. So these were the concoctions that were being put in the eyes at the time. As you can imagine, I don't actually have numbers on what John Taylor's overall success rate was like, but neither procedure was successful with either Bach or Handel. In Bach's case, he didn't live very long after the fact. I don't think it would be fair to say that there was a cause there. He lived about 4 months after the procedure. In Handel's case, his life went on quite a bit longer, but in either case, neither one recovered their sight.